This opening verse describes that Bhagavad Gita is like our mother, which destroys the bondage. The bondage that ensues from being entangled in this creation, forgetting our real nature. So it brings the knowledge of oneness or non-duality, as it is said in the beginning, Advaitamrita Varshini, that it showers the knowledge of non-duality of self. The self is one and same everywhere. That is the one existence that appears as many all around us. It is a great proposition and can be verified by everyone in our life when we understand that proposition, that statement in the bottom of our heart. Then we will see the life attains its fulfillment. And that great statement is that the self in different bodies and different beings is not really different. It is one self that appears in many bodies, like the one ocean appearing in many waves. Now these waves look multiple, but the ocean is one. So the one same ocean is in every wave, and that ocean is the real nature of each wave. The wave rises, goes on increasing in size and in height, and then starts falling and merges back. Likewise, we all beings also are born, grow, start decaying, and go back. Where do we come from? Where do we go back to? It is that oneness, like the waves arising from the ocean and going back into it. While they are seen separate, yet in the essence, they are really all one. They, even when we see them as wave, in actuality, in reality, they are nothing but ocean. So even now, all that we see is nothing but that one self. Theistically, one may call that as God. God, which is the reality or dwelling ground of this whole existence, that is like the ocean which manifests like all of us in different waves. So when that knowledge dawns on us, this knowledge is not just the information, but it has to seep into our nervous system. It has to become our experience. And thus, while seeing the plurality, we will be aware of the intrinsic unity of the whole existence. It is the idea of separation that creates a lot of problems and tremendous contradictions in our life. One example of it is that we feel love and hate. It is love and hate obviously are not one and the same. They are in fact opposite of each other, and yet they are felt kind of together. The place where you feel love, after a while that very being or that very person one feels hatred about. So the love and hate, why do we feel like that? The answer is really there is that abiding oneness. That abiding oneness, when it is, we see the separation, it is a very important the phenomena, psychological phenomena takes place. That when in the one you see separateness, then because it is against the truth, that separateness is against the truth, you get the tendency to unite. That is called love. What is love? Where you feel the sense of oneness in although there are two different beings. You feel oneness. Why so? Because there is nothing but one in essence. And so, as soon as you feel separateness, you feel the sense of love. Oh, we are one. And as soon as you try to accommodate that oneness in multiplicity, you feel that that is not possible, and then the hatred comes in. It is, you try to become one, but then two things can never become one. Two things cannot be same or one in all respects. So the attempt at external oneness gets rebuffed. Like you throw a ball on the wall, it comes back and it gets rebound. So similarly, the attempt at becoming one, they do not actually result in oneness. And thus, a reaction ensues. That reaction is then called hatred. So, love and hatred, these contradictory things we find together in our day-to-day experience. So, why this contradiction? Because of lack of this understanding of oneness. When one comes to the experience of this oneness, then these contradictions, they completely resolve, and one attains that sense of fulfillment in life. So, this is the purpose of Bhagavad Gita, to impart this knowledge to us. And one way of getting this knowledge seeped in us is to work with that spirit. The idea that one gets is that this work is not in harmony with this knowledge or the meditative spirit. I want to be calm, and work causes disturbance. So, to become calm, we try to run away from work. Work creates disturbance, so many difficulties, the clash with the boss and all other problems, competitions and struggles and misunderstandings, they all come because of work. So the idea comes that if I want to be calm, meditative, thinking about my real self, then what I need to do is stop working. This work is so difficult. Leave me alone and then see how calm I am. One does not become calm by living alone. Try for 10 minutes, we start seeking company, and then dial on the phone to somebody, start talking. It is leave me alone, I don't want any work. We want to get over the work as soon as we get it, want to finish it. And when we are without work, we start worrying. Oh, I need work. We all start craving for work. This is again another contradiction. So, stopping work is not a solution. Stopping work, in fact, will complicate the problem further. And therefore, Lord Krishna tells his beloved disciple Arjuna that, and through Arjuna to all of us, that Do your work. Don't try to run away from it. Work is the great means for cultivating this knowledge within us. Through work, one learns. That learning comes through properly doing one's duty. Even apart from getting this knowledge, even for just the mundane considerations of survival in the society, we need to perform our duty. And just think, you know, that if we don't do our duty, all of us, our social fabric will not survive. Even for the survival of our social fabric, we need to do work. So, therefore, Lord Krishna tells Arjuna that you have to do work. And then it is said that, told that everybody's duty is not same. People are constitutionally different, and therefore they incur or they start doing different duties. Like one coat cannot fit every size. Similarly, all one duty cannot fit every person. And because we feel that my duty is the right thing, whenever we feel something to be right, this is another very beautiful psychological phenomena, that when we feel that something is right, we immediately universalize it, that it is right for everyone. Like you may just think that smoking is bad, immediately a moral thing is created around it. Smoking is bad, bad for all, should not be allowed at all. It is, when we do something as a matter of liking, that doesn't happen. There was a nice article in New York Times I forgot the name. It is a very nice article that when we make something as a matter of just choice, we do not attach any moral value to it. But when, as soon as we put a moral value to something, then we tend to universalize it. So duty, because it has a moral value, we try to feel that this is the duty of everyone. Like you feel, one may feel it is my duty to join the army. Excellent idea, but if you universalize, one tends to universalize then it is the duty of each and everyone to do that. And then it becomes a problem. One may think that to do the farming is my duty. It is good for the society, and one immediately universalizes that so everybody must do farming, and thus one gets problem. And one may like music and feel that yes, everybody, I should sing and do some music. Immediately, if it gets that yes, everybody in the world should be steeped in music, it is not like that. The tendencies, the capabilities differ from person to person. The station in life is different. In Bhagavad Gita, later on we will see a lot of discussion about that. But the duties differ according to the station in life, in the sense that when you are a child, your duty is different than when you become an adult. And the station in life, the station of your particular vocation, that also determines it. The duty that you need to do is also dependent on the needs of the society. And all those things become differentiating factors about duty. So, one should not impose one's own ideal about duty on others. Also, people are at various stages of spiritual growth. One may be having a lot of meditative temperament, and so feels that I will grow through meditation. But others may not have that temperament. It is very difficult for most people in the world to meditate even for 5-10 minutes. Is very difficult. The words come very cheap, you know, that I was meditating for 1 hour. It is seen in many places that if they are told to meditate for 30 minutes, somewhere the sound of snoring starts coming, you know. Instead of meditation, they go directly into samadhi. So, it is. Or the mind starts roaming about everywhere. It is not easy to meditate. So, very few people have really that psychological capability to sit and concentrate on God. Our minds are so scattered that it is very difficult to make it concentrated on a object, on a higher object. On the lower objects it gets concentrated, you know. For example, if you like football, then you will be with great interest, with full concentration, watching the football game. You will forget that you need to take food, you will forget many other things, you know, that you otherwise will keep on reminding you. But there's so much concentration comes if you like something, but on some higher thing that you really feel is an elevating for you, it is difficult to concentrate. So one has to come to that level, and that level is attained through properly working and following some other disciplines too. So, Lord Krishna tells Arjuna here that people need to do work, and don't, even if you feel that meditation is right or giving up of work is right for you, don't disturb others. Nobody should work, everybody should meditate. That is not the constitution of everyone. They will not be able to do that. So the 29th verse says, Prakriter gunasammudha sajjante gunakarmasu tana krishna vido mandan krishna vinna vichalayet. And this is the 29th verse from the 3rd chapter. Being deluded by the constituents of prakriti, people get attached to the senses and their functions. He who knows everything should not unsettle these people who are dull-witted and imperfect in knowledge. And this dull-witted and imperfect in knowledge is not told as, it is not used in a derogatory sense. It is dull-witted, only the good-witted are those, according to this, who see the ultimate truth. All others are in various degrees of dull-wittedness. Seeing multiplicity and not seeing unity is dull-wittedness. Seeing God that exists everywhere, not seeing that, and seeing the non-existent form and considering them as real, it is not certainly the example of good, highest wit. It is again a dull-wittedness. So we have all some different levels of dull-wittedness, and accordingly we have to rise higher and higher and improve ourselves to get to that vision where we will see that oneness pervading everything. So, and in the next verse, therefore Lord tells that you should do work, but how? The ideal of work is described in next verse and the following two verses. These three verses are very important. In fact, Swami Sarvagatananda, many of you know him. Swami Sarvagatananda calls this particular verse, the 30th verse of the third chapter, as the yoga described by Krishna or prescribed by Krishna. It is, therefore he calls it Krishna Yoga. There is that book in the library written by him, Krishna Yoga, because according to him, and there is merit in what he says, it is, he has given all his teachings here, and like the Sermon on the Mount, where Lord Jesus says that this is what you should do. If you do this, you will attain to Supreme. If you don't do this, you will cause your own downfall. Similar words are used by Krishna here. So, let us study these important verses now. Mayi sarvani karmani sanyasyadhyatma chetasa nirashir nirmamo bhutva yudhyasva vigata jvaraha. Renouncing all actions in me with your mind resting on the self and giving up hope and idea of ownership, fight being free from fever. The words are to be properly understood. The translation may be misleading for many. Worship, fight being free from fever doesn't mean that you should take a Tylenol if you have fever and then do. That is, the fever here means too much attachment and enthusiasm that accompanies it, excitement. Fever here really means terrible excitement about these things. That you should not feel excited that, yes, I have to do this war. Do it as duty. Doing your duty, you are doing it because it is your duty, not because you feel excited about it. This is now a word that is used in United States for even the most minor things. One get excited, you know, that are you getting excited about that movie? Every now and then people get excited about something or the other. It is all the excitement. So it is this excitement has to go out of one's works. Works should not be done out of excitement, but with the sense of one's, that it is one's duty. That is the meaning of free from fever, that don't get too much excited. Do not feel that this is something that you are doing out of, because you are on fire for that, doing it. And don't do it as a matter of that mob enthusiasm, or just because people say that it will be very nice if we do it. And do it as a matter of duty. And how this duty should be done? The first sentence is, renouncing all actions in me, that is Lord. Give up all actions, dedicate them to Lord. Dedicate all these actions to Lord. And this is like bhakti yoga, and the yoga of devotion. Whatever we are doing, make it into a worship. Dedicate it to God. What is the difference between work and worship? Every work, if done with the feeling of dedication to God, then that becomes worship. In worship, when say we are doing worship, Maybe we are waving a candle or offering food or flower. What is being done? It is an action. Why that action becomes worship? It becomes worship only because of the attitude of dedication associated with it. Sans that attitude, it is a work. Even if somebody is ritually performing a worship, if the attitude is not that of dedication, actually, mentally speaking, it is not worship at all. Somebody may be appointed as a priest to do worship. Now that person may be doing it just to get the salary, the monthly that income from it, and is doing the work just mechanically, that yes, this work will bring me money. Now, although the work may be the same, the attitude is not that of dedication, and although therefore it may be get called worship, is it worship? It is not worship. On the other hand, somebody may be doing some other work, say cooking, that we all do cooking to eat. So, while doing cooking, that if somebody feels, yes, I will offer this to God, then what happens? That becomes a worship there. That cooking becomes worship. Any work will become worship if that is done with the spirit of dedication. That dedication is what changes it from the ordinary work to worship. An action becomes ordinary work that tends to bind. But put the spirit of dedication to God, and that very action then becomes worship. So there is no such distinction between the actions, that these are the actions of worship. These are the just the ordinary actions. The external shape of the action doesn't matter. In the 18th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, this topic will be again illustrated, that just as in worship you offer flowers at the for Lord, you offer the flowers. He said that in the 18th chapter, that make your work as the flower. Let you may say make a flower garland for the Lord. Now let each action of yours become one flower in that garden, that garland. See, that becomes then each action becomes worship through this idea of dedication to God. And dedicate every action to God. Thus, what happens? You do not get tied down or bound by the reactions of it. Otherwise, every action, because of the selfish motive associated with it, will become a binding force in your life. It breeds a bondage. It gives rise to impressions, that impressions again create those actions, and it becomes an unending process, a terrible bondage in one's life. And therefore, those very actions which one performs, those very actions are to be changed in nature through the spirit of worship. The actions are, you know, the outer forms of actions are like the capsules that you are given medicine in from. Now, the outer that capsule, that cover, is not the medicine. The medicine is filled in them. And what acts on us to cure is the medicine. If the capsule may be very beautiful, but inside if it is poison, then just by taking that capsule one will get killed. So it is not the capsule, the shape or the color of the capsule, but what Triveni? The medicine in it, is it not? That acts. That medicine in the our capsule becomes the active force in curing us. Similarly, our actions are like capsules. They are to be filled with the spirit of dedication. Thus, taken in this way, then only they have the curing value. Then only they have the medicinal value. Instead, what normally is filled is poison in it. Our selfish attitude. I do this action, then I will get this, then I will do this. It never ends, goes on and on. That is what one mistakenly calls as progress. Swami Vivekananda therefore says that in modern civilization, multiplication of one's desires gets the name of progress. What a silly idea. The more the desire, the more the bondage. The more the desire, more the restlessness. Desires make us restless. Desires are the biggest impediment, rather the only impediment in our getting peace. We cannot be peaceful with desires. And therefore, this idea of progress should be to eliminate the desires. And how can we do that? By substituting the selfishness and attachment in the actions by the spirit of dedication. Then the whole action in its effect gets changed. Swami Vivekananda has written a very nice book, a small book that I refer to every now and then while discussing these things. And that book is titled Karma Yoga, the Yoga of Action, wherein these ideas have been illustrated in very beautiful way in modern language with modern examples and modern treatment. It is there he says that work has two components. In the very first chapter he mentions that the work has two components. The external effect of work and the internal effect, the effect of the work on worker. The effect on work outside is one thing, but like you did the work, say, of making bread. Excellent that the bread got made, you and others and all, they ate it. That is one external effect of it. You get praise or blame for depending on how you made that. The bread came out nice. People will say, oh, wow, very nice. If that didn't come well, then they won't say good word about you. On your back they may say, oh, it is. That is the external effect of the work. Now, internal effect of the work, while you were doing that work of making bread, you were just making the dough properly, then rolling it nicely, putting it into that oven, and all, if you were doing it very well, but with the idea of dedication to God, then the whole thing changes. While you were doing the work was acting on you. It was training you. It was molding you. That aspect of work plays the pivotal role in yoga of action. How the work works on the worker. The work works outside on the world. That is a comparatively insignificant aspect of it. how the work affects the worker. Work, if it is not done with the spirit of dedication, done very well, one starts seeking praise, appreciation. One starts feeling that, yes, I should be adequately reimbursed or paid for that work. If not, then we feel a sense of grudge. And our expectations, especially the expectations of appreciation, recognition, they are psychological. The expectation on the physical plane that, yes, I will get reimbursed for this work or I will get money for this work is comparatively not that important. What really drives a person and binds that person is the craving for recognition. It is comparatively easy to give up the seeking of the external, I mean the result of like money. I will get it, I will not get it, it will come. But the idea of recognition is much deeper. That, see, I did all the work, you know, but that fellow took the credit. Because we stay in the Brown University circles, I get to hear this very often. Because there is that academic thing, rivalries and all that, they play a big role. Not that all academicians, because they are highly learned, they are all beyond these things, and not so. Grunting, that grudge, it is all right. Because they are educated, they express in a very sophisticated terms. That's all. But it is the spirit of real murder is there inside. I am not exaggerating at all. It is expressed in a very sophisticated manner, that's all. Maybe an ordinary, some other not so educated person or will just say that I would go and kill him. A professor will say basically the same thing in different words, that's all. It is. Because the idea of recognition is very strong. I should get my recognition. I should get the respect. People should acknowledge my this thing. I did such an important work and nobody really took notice of it. What is this? It is all these ideas, they come because we put that poison of attachment into the work. There is no dedication there. Dedication to God, then you do finish, my job is done. It is very difficult to get rid of this idea of recognition. It takes long practice. One should not feel depressed because one has it. Let it be just acknowledged that I need to work on that, that's all. It is not that it is the story of all of us, the monks included. Monks do not fall from skies. They are as flesh and blood as everybody else. So all of them, all of us have to work towards this end of giving up this idea of seeking some such results from the work and do it with the spirit of dedication, dedication to Lord. And we get all that we need, we will get hundredfold out of it. Don't think that if I do this with the spirit of dedication, immediately when I tell this, people tell, Swami, you do not know the atmosphere in our university or in here or there. You don't know that how vicious it is at the work, you see. You are nice in the sitting in the Vedanta society and you don't have to bother. It is not so. We are all in the same boat. One has to work, not to recognize it, and work to eliminate it. It is, therefore, the spirit of dedication to Lord needs to be cultivated with lot of conscious efforts. In the beginning it is a conscious effort, then it becomes natural, then whatever one does automatically is filled with the spirit of dedication. You don't have to consciously do it, but in the beginning, this beginning can be continued for 60 years, 70 years, or lifetime, who knows, you know, that will, or many lifetimes too. Depends on how fast and how sincerely one works at it. That at various levels of our being, it is our psyche is a very deep thing. At various levels, the selfishness, the desire to get recognition, desire to have many other things, that is that creeps in. It is therefore one has to be very careful in keeping our efforts alive to remove this. So the spirit of dedication, that offer, dedicate all your actions at the feet of God. Then, adhyatma chetasa, with your mind resting on the self. Know that you are not the body and the mind. See, when we try to feel this truth, this is truth that we are not body and the mind. It is very easy to intellectually understand that body and mind, they are the changing things. The unchanging reality is not that changing phenomena. This is simple to understand intellectually, but one has to practice this, that I am not this continuously changing body and mind. And that is, I am the self, I am everywhere, I am in everything. That is how the work should be done. That is how, when Jesus said that love thy neighbor as thyself, the great teaching of similar type, you know, that see that the self here, thyself, is in the neighbor too. And neighbor here is to be, of course, taken in the extended sense, not just one who lives exactly in the next compound. And neighbor is a big term. It is everybody, whosoever comes in our contact, should be seen as ourself. And then the life becomes very different. You know. Wherever we see the same self, the idea of competition, quarrel, becoming superior to somebody automatically vanishes. To give you an example, I like that example a lot. Take different components of our body, different organs. My left hand, my right hand, my eyes, my nose, my mouth, my belly, all these things, my heart. Everybody, all they work in unison without any competition. You never can imagine the idea of the quarrel between them. That suppose the food is to be taken, the hand will say otherwise. See, I do all the work, and the mouth just keeps on talking and wants to eat all. What is this? I will not give anything to the mouth. The eyes will come in play. Eyes will say, I spotted it. Hand, you might have taken it. But who showed you where it is? I showed you. I should get the major share of the food. What do you mean? The lungs will say, who were doing the pumping work? Hand, you moved. But who made you move? I made you move. You see, why you are taking so much of pride in that? You are nothing. If I stop, you won't be able to move. The legs will say, fellow, the food was there actually. Could you go there without me? Now imagine, if they all start quarreling, what will happen? Do you ever see them quarreling? No. Why? Because oneness. There is an intrinsic awareness of oneness that pervades all of these. And therefore, the quarrel is impossible. Now imagine, if one gets this feel of oneness with whole existence, can there be any such problem of competition, problem of greed, problem of possessing? You actually see that people who get this feel go beyond all these things. Take the great life of Sri Ramakrishna. You will see how the slightest idea of I and mine was not possible for him. He was very sick with cancer, throat cancer. That incident, and many such incidents took place in his life to illustrate this. In fact, every action was manifestation of this oneness. He was very sick, and once one great scholar came to see him and told him that, in the yoga, it is told that people who are so advanced in that discipline like you just need to concentrate their minds on this throat and the cancer will go away. And immediately, Sri Ramakrishna's disciples, chief amongst them was Narendranath, who became then Swami Vivekananda. He said that you must do that, at least for our sake. You are not concerned about your giving a body, but we all look for up to you. So if you give up the body, it will be a terrible blow to us. So for our sake, at least, you must do it. Sri Ramakrishna, fully always dedicated to the Divine Mother, said, I don't know anything. Mother knows everything. Then go and tell Mother. Narendranath was very strong in argumenting, so he was not going to give up. Okay, then go and tell Mother. And Sri Ramakrishna couldn't say no. Talking itself was very difficult for him, and arguing with Narendra means it was an unending affair. So he just kept quiet, said, okay. Then after a while, Narendra comes again. Did you ask the Divine Mother about it? Sri Ramakrishna's face was just very morose and kind of sunk, which the shame was written on all his face. Can you imagine Sri Ramakrishna's face like that? He was... And Narendra asked, what did the Divine Mother say? She said, when I told her that I didn't say that cure me, but showed that look, it gives a lot of pain here, can't eat even this thing. So make a little bit such thing that I will be able to eat something, a little bit at least. Then what did the Divine Mother say? Divine Mother said, shame on you! Shame on you! Who is eating through all the millions and millions mouths? Who is eating through all of these? And Sri Ramakrishna said, it is truth. Why do you need a separate, different mouth for a particular body? It is the consciousness, the awareness that I am this brings the problem there. It is the great awareness of oneness. We shall continue to discuss this verse more. There are two more important aspects regarding it. First, we saw the two, the aspect of the yoga of devotion, and dedicate all actions to Lord, and the second part that can be called yoga of discrimination or knowledge, jnana yoga, that focusing on the truth that you are not the body, not the mind, but you are the all-pervading self. It is like telling the wave, a wave telling oneself that you are not this shape, you are the ocean, you are the infinite ocean. And we are all infinite. That is why we crave for infinite. All our cravings are like that, infinite. And we don't want limited. How much happiness do we want? We can't put an upper limit. Think in our consciousness, you know. In our mind, we refuse to put an upper limit to that. And we want unlimited happiness. How much love do you want? Well, can you put an upper limit to that? All the real important things that we care for in life, we cannot put an upper limit on that. It is infinite. We want infinite because we are that. It is only our clinging to limitedness makes us limited. What makes or what prevents a wave from becoming an ocean? What prevents a wave from becoming an ocean? Only that imbecile attachment to its wavehood, that's all. It is not ready to give up that wavehood. If it stops thinking that I am the wave, it is ocean. It is ocean. We are all divine. We are all infinite. Only this is to be stopped, considering ourselves to be these little bodies. So, this is the knowledge that we are the Self. And this is to be practiced. The two other things how to learn concentration and how to do our different actions in this spirit, that with detachment. That detachment part will be told the last one. So we will see that the time is already finished.